Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. It is going to be Passover already. This Saturday night is the first Seder. I have to, just as an aside and not a food aside, I don't like it when Passover starts on Friday because it makes the Seders so much longer when it's on the Sabbath. You have to, there are extra prayers and things to do. So, but it's starting Saturday night after Sabbath is over. And so that means you're not going to eat until very, very late if you're really observant. Anyway, I am a big fan of a Jewish cookbook writer named Robert Sternberg, who is in fact Rabbi Robert Sternberg, a rabbi who went to culinary school and wrote a very important book for me, for anybody who's interested in Jewish food culture, called Yiddish Cuisine. The subtitle is A Gourmet's Approach to Jewish Cooking. Ah, the G word. I'm not a big fan of the word gourmet. I'm a believer in what James Beard once said. He said, they asked him, well, a grandmother who was a kosher caterer, and he learned a lot at his grandmother's knee. And this book reflects his grandmother's cooking, but more why she was Polish. And there's a lot of very good Polish-Jewish recipes in here. By the way, when I say Polish-Jewish, some of them would be the same as if you were Polish-Christian, and some of them would not be, because, of course, the Polish Jews followed the dietary laws, whereas Christians were able to eat pork. Pork, and Christians were able to combine milk and dairy and meat, which Jews don't do either. But also there's a lot of Hungarians. I mean, wonderful recipes, wonderful notes. When I was writing my own book, Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, I read this book over and over again. When I finally got a copy of it, because at that time, I'm talking about, I guess it was the mid-90s, this book had been published already, but it was impossible to find at that time a price I could afford. I mean, it was only in secondary market, so to speak, on Amazon, that you could find this book sold by various dealers. And sometimes the book would go up to like $1,000. I mean, it was hundreds of dollars. My guess is, I have yet to meet Robert Sternberg, but I'm trying to. He lives in St. Louis, and my niece lives in St. Louis, and my niece is very active in the St. Louis conservative Jewish, maybe they're reformed, Jewish community. I know that they have to be reformed because one of her rabbis is a woman. But anyway, she's trying to find Robert Sternberg for me. So the book has a copyright of 1993. It only was published in soft cover, and I think in a very, very limited printing. So by the mid '90s, just a few years after it was published, people had heard about it. I heard about it, but it was hard to obtain. I finally got a copy. It's right here in front of me, and there's a million zillion things in here that I would cook any day of the week, and some of them I do, because they overlap so much with my own Jewish cooking, which we both, Robert Sternberg and I, consider Yiddish cooking. Meaning the food of the Eastern European Jews, where Yiddish was the main language. People ask me, did your grandfather... I have one grandparent who was born in the old country, in Belarus, and they always ask, did your grandfather speak Russian? And I said, no, he spoke Yiddish. But in fact, my grandfather came over as a little boy, and he spoke perfect English with no accent at all. But anyway... Robert Sternberg wrote this book, Yiddish Cuisine, which is his food, because he's also Eastern European. And then he wrote another book called The Sephardic Kitchen, which is subtitled The Healthful Food and Rich Culture of the Mediterranean Jews. Now, if you lived in Brooklyn now, and you were Jewish, even if you were kosher, you would be very, very familiar with Sephardic food because we have so many Sephardic people in Brooklyn. Not all, but a good deal of them originate from Syria, Syrian Jews, Aleppo in particular. So some of them even think of themselves as Aleppo Jews, and their food is totally, totally different, of course, than somebody who cooks in Lithuania, where the climate is, everything's different. Now, the word Sephardic designates people who originated in Spain. They didn't originate in Spain, but in the diaspora, these are the Jews that settled on the Iberian Peninsula, Portugal as well. You know, that's why they say Columbus's mission to in 1492, if he himself was not Jewish, and there's speculation that he was, many of the men who were on his boats were Jewish because they were trying to get away from the Inquisition, which was going on at the same time. But those Jews were eventually expelled from Spain and Portugal by the Inquisition, and they ended up in more hospitable places like Turkey, Greece, Morocco. I actually have a cousin by marriage whose family went to Morocco, and she grew up in Morocco. She married my cousin while he was in the Air Force there. And so those are the Sephardic Jews. They have a lot, their food has a lot in common because it has that Iberian base. But then, of course, Jews always adapt to the place that they're living in. So eventually, Sephardic Spanish traditions overlapped with and came common even in Egyptian cooking. What can I say? It's a very interesting, when you say Sephardic cuisine, you're really talking about a lot of different cuisines. So I'm thinking about Robert Sternberg apropos of Passover, and I realize I never really did get in touch with this man who I'm a fan of. And he lives in St. Louis. I actually call my niece, now that, you know, my niece is well established in St. Louis. So I call my niece and say, do you ever hear of or know of Rabbi Robert Sternberg? And she says, funny you should mention. I just clipped a recipe of his to make for Passover. And I didn't know who he was, except that I saw this article. It's in the St. Louis Jewish newspaper. Told you my niece is very active in the Jewish community. And it's a really interesting recipe. I'm going to make it. Now, this is not a recipe you would make for a Seder. It's a recipe you would make during the week. It's more or less, maybe less than more, the Sephardic version of matzah brei. Now, do you know matzah brei, Marshall?
Yeah.
You like matzah brei?
Yeah.
You're not enthusiastic.
And yeah, I like it. Let me put it this way. As a kid, it was available. I ate it.
No. I make it. This only because I'm on a no-carb diet did I not make it in January or February. But matzah lasts forever.
Yeah.
And I always buy too much matzah now, this time of the year, in the spring. And then sometime in January or February, when I don't want to go out shopping and I'm rummaging around to see what can I make, I find some matzah and I make matzah brei, and we love it. So I love matzah brei. Matzah brei is broken up matzah, soaked in water. Actually, I take I take hot water from a kettle. I boil water in a tea kettle, and I slowly pour it over the broken matzah in a colander, so that the matzah gets soaked, but not mushy. And then you mix that soaked, well, not soaked, but moistened matzah in with beaten eggs. If you want to add a little milk to that, you can. It's a dairy dish. Because I don't like cooking this in oil, by the way. I only like cooking this in butter because I like my eggs in butter. And I make a version of matzah brei that's like scrambled eggs with matzah in it. But the matzah, being soaked and then cooked with the eggs, turns out to taste like noodles. And in fact, in Sephardic cuisine, too, they use matzah as a sort of noodle substitute. You're not allowed to eat noodles on Passover. They're a product of wheat flour. Even I think if they're a product of... Sephardic people have different rules about keeping Passover. because, for instance, beans were such a vital part of their diet. They eat beans at Passover. I think there's some Sephardim who also eat rice, which seems very strange to me as somebody who grew up in a household where the only kind of wheat product, or starchy product for that matter, was matzah. And its forms. There's also matzah cake meal, with which we made some cakes, and there's matzah meal, which is more coarsely ground matzah than matzah cake meal. Cake meal, by the way, is very, very hard to find, I see. Once Passover starts, there's no more cake meal in the stores. And I do remember a number of years ago when I had to, if you're very Orthodox, you do not moisten matzah until the last 2 days of Passover, at which point you want to use up, you know, we're always practical, you want to use up whatever's left over, so they allow you to make matzah brei, or matzah balls for that matter. I use matzah meal for matzah balls, matzah cake meal for cakes and other kinds of Passover sweets, and, of course, matzah itself in whole pieces and broken. So the version from Robert Sternberg, the Sephardic version of what he sort of thinks is a Sephardic matzah brei, is you take the matzah boards and whole ones, and you find a nice, I have actually a square pan that fits matzah boards perfectly, because you don't want it too much bigger than the matzah boards. And you put your, let's say, you know, four matzah boards in a dish, and you pour over milk and let them soak. Now, this is the only tricky part of this whole recipe, is that you've got to judge. You've got to make a real judgment here about when the matzah is soft enough but not mushy. And then when you take them out, you have to cut each matzah board into fourths, four pieces per matzah board. And on the side, you beat up some eggs because this is a Greek-Turkish and Turkish version, you beat your eggs. I can give you the exact measurements in a minute. You beat the eggs with a little bit of yogurt. And you can use Greek yogurt for this, I'm sure, but regular yogurt, unsweetened yogurt. We're talking about plain yogurt. It will do. And, of course, some salt and pepper. And you heat up about a quarter of an inch of oil. Now, what oil do you use on Passover? You can. There are only certain vegetable oils. And I like to buy, it's my time of year to buy, Arthur, not walnut oil. It'll come to me. So anyway, you fry each one of these pieces of matzah that's been soaked in milk and then dipped in egg until it gets nice and brown, and drain it on paper towel and you eat it. Now, you eat it with syrup, according to Rabbi Sternberg. And he gives you a recipe. I thought this was really interesting. He gives you a recipe for raisin syrup, if you want to make it. Otherwise, you can just use honey. But raisin syrup, you take raisins and boil them until they basically become pulp, and then you strain it, and then boil it down again until it's nice and thick, like honey, is very similar to the syrup that they make in southern Italy, vincotto, cooked wine, because it's the same idea, except that the grapes have not been turned into raisins. Actually, in southern Italy, they might be using some some raisins that got, you know, dried a little bit. It makes them even sweeter. But you do the same thing. And it's because, of course, in these places, in the old days, I mean, truly, even in the 19th century, didn't have sugar. Or if they did have sugar, it was very expensive. It was a luxury product. Certainly, ultra-refined white sugar was a real luxury. So the sweetener of choice was made from grapes. And apparently in Turkey and Greece, they do the same thing, except they're using raisins. And that's it. It's a really simple recipe and something you would make for the family, like we do matzah brei, during the week. Now, not at a Seder, because At a Seder, is even in the Haggadah, which is the plan, the rules, the order. Actually, Haggadah means order. The order of the Seder, it says, like two-thirds through, eat a festive meal. So in my experience, among Eastern European Jews, festive meant meat. Hence, brisket. I'm not sure how brisket became the meat of choice among Eastern European Jews, but it was. I mean, there was corned beef, of course. That's a preserved meat. But fresh brisket, just an aside here, my mother got a new recipe for brisket. My mother was always trying out new recipes for brisket. And one year, she accidentally bought a corned beef instead of a fresh brisket. I mean, corned beef is made from brisket.
Yeah.
And she glazed she cooked the corned beef, as she would a brisket. And I have done this since. It's sensational, but a little salty. Anyway, so a brisket became the festive meal of choice among Eastern European Jews. Unfortunately, the meat itself, brisket, is not what it used to be. And I'm not the only one who says this. It's the what they call first cut, which gives people the impression it's the better cut, as opposed to second cut, or sometimes called thick cut, which is actually another muscle that's on top of the flat cut, first cut. First cut is also called flat cut. And besides that, the meat itself has become a lot leaner over decades because of American breeding. And I mean, you can buy good brisket. I'm not saying you can't, but supermarket level brisket, even my butcher's brisket, is too lean for me. And I rarely make brisket these days. Although, if I see a piece of deckel, which is the thick cut, second cut, I'll make that, because that's very, very well marbled, succulent meat, which is what we always used to think brisket was. But that is the festive meal of most people's Passovers. I'm not sure what the Sephardim, I actually call a Sephardic friend and say, what do you eat for Passover? But anyway, my book, by the way, I'm going to plug my book, is called Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking. It is still in print. It is available on Amazon, or who knows if it's in a bookstore anymore. But, you know, that's the way these things go these days. You have to order anything that's not 6 months, that's more than 6 months old. People don't realize this, but bookstores don't display books for more than 6 months. They feel the main selling life of a book is the first 6 months of its publication. And Jewish Home Cooking has been out, I don't know, 20 years?
Oh, no.
15 years? I don't know. It still sells. I still get royalties.
Hey, it adds up.
believe me, they're not a lot of money. It just barely pays for a dinner a year. So, it's a nice book. I like that book. By the way, it was edited by a Protestant minister's wife. And it was the most respectful, careful editing I've ever had of my seven cookbooks. It by far was the most pleasurable work experience because I had a respectful editor. To a large extent, my family cooking. I stole a couple of things, I think, from Robert Sternberg, maybe some historical information, because he's good on that. And Robert Sternberg's books are not in print, that I know of. They're not in print. But you can still buy them if you go to Amazon. The Sephardic book should be readily available. I'm not sure about Yiddish cuisine. I haven't checked on that in a long time, because I have my own copy. And what else about Passover? So I look forward to Passover, but a lot of people dread a whole week of matzah eating. And besides that, it's a little, you may have to do some laxative work.
You know, you know, a couple of years ago,
if you eat matzah every day for a week, but
you know, a couple of years ago, you mentioned this with matzah, and you know what I tried with matzah, and it worked really. I made matzah lasagna.
That, right. In fact, that's another Sephardic way with matzah. Almost all the Sephards from whatever country, and they're called minas, M-I-N-A-S, minas. And you make layers of soaked matzah with, I don't know, what are you putting in yours?
I put one layer of tomatoes, then I put another layer of matzah, and I put some cheese in, another layer with tomatoes. It's all vegetarian, and then I just build it up. And then
vegan, even. No, it's not with cheese.
No. But it came out kind of cool, actually.
No. They're very good. And that's what I'm saying. People use matzah. All right, I didn't say this on the air. I said this to Jill earlier this morning. You know, Jill has a phobia against soaked bread. I mean, she won't even eat French toast. So I was describing minas to her, and she was going, ooh, you know. But in fact, it's sort of a substitute for noodles. I mean, even in matzah brei, it's scrambled eggs with noodles, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm sure with this this Sephardic matzah brei, where you soak it in milk and then dip it in egg and yogurt and fry, is also like a noodle substitute. And the same thing with those, as you rightly call it a matzah lasagna.
You know, it's funny. Back in the old days, if Jill doesn't like that, it's a good thing Jill wasn't around in the 50s or early 60s, where she had an ulcer. You know what they prescribed to my mother for her ulcer? Bread soaked in milk. That was an actual prescription to deal with her ulcer.
Well, I don't know. Milk? I thought milk was not good for ulcers.
I don't know. I don't know. I think what actually would have been better had she just left my father at the time.
Well, you know what that's called? Milk toast.
Yeah. Well, that's what
they used to. And it's so bland.
Yeah.
That's why they call people who are, I don't know,
yeah,
bland, milk toast. You know, he's a milk toast. I actually, you know, I being on this keto diet, I actually do crave dunking.
dunking's one of the favorite things in the world.
You know, we had dinner. We were at my nephew's in Philly for the weekend, and well, long weekend. And I don't know. One night we had stuff I could eat, and then I said to Brian, oh, but you know, I'm so I never think of starch anymore. What do we have to, what can I serve with all this stuff? He said, well, we have bread. So, and he made a little oil dunking sauce, and I was so jealous. He sat there dunking his bread into wonderful oil, I have to say. Oil part I could have, but I couldn't have the bread. And you know, anytime I make anything, that's why I'm not braising lately. How can you eat gravy without bread?
Well, they
or potatoes.
I mean, dunking is a fine art that's good for anything. It's good for anything.
My only dunker these days is endive leaves.
Well, at least you can dunk them, though.
It's not the same in gravy. It's okay with baba ganoush, but not with gravy. I'll have to figure that one out. Well, the other day, somebody asked me, well, what do you eat for breakfast? And I rattled off a few things that I eat for breakfast, and every one of them disgusted them. So I eat differently. I mean, my favorite breakfast these days is a herring fillet. I found a good source of nice whole herring fillets, and it was smeared with sour cream. To me, that's heaven. I would like a cracker or a piece of bread with it, but I'm managing without.
Well, I've gone back to the old thing where I have two eggs. I have two eggs for breakfast. I started eating breakfast when I started this diet so I could have three meals a day.
Right. Well, you're doing fabulously well. How much have you lost so far?
It's now 78 pounds.
But it's, oh, my.
But, yeah, but it comes to about 6.5 pounds a month is what it comes out to.
I'm losing at the same rate. I'm losing about 6 pounds a month.
And it's not easy. Has it changed? See, I'm not as... I still prepare food.
I'm down 42 pounds, by the way. Now.
I still prepare food as if I was at the start of the diet, but I found out that I had to cut down my preparation because I only could eat about half the amount that I prepared.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Listen, I brought four sensational rib steaks to Brian, and I ate the top of the rib part off of one steak, and that's all I could eat. And we actually... Six adults. five adults. We couldn't even finish four steaks. And, well, my niece doesn't have that big an appetite, but Brian has an enormous appetite. Anyway, I'm losing a little bit more a week at this moment, only because my appetite is so diminished.
Yeah, but that, yeah, no. So you're losing it at the same rate that I am, basically.
Yeah, about 6 pounds a month.
I just started. You know, I started earlier than you, but I've got no complaints. You know,
and I also will add, you're younger than I am.
As you
get older, it gets harder and harder.
Well, every morning when I wake up, it's hard to convince me that I'm not old.
tell me, I know, but I've been. People have been telling me how youthful I am lately. I don't know if it's to be kind or if it's true, but it makes me feel good.
I just know when I get up in the morning, my body makes more noise than I do.
And I do think that has made me more energetic, and Bob a little bit more energetic. But on the other hand, we have a next-door neighbor who's a real hypochondriac. And Bob asked me, well, how do you feel today? And he said, well, I'm feeling pretty good, except he's 71 or 2. Except that I do get very fatigued in the afternoon. I said, welcome to the 70s.
All right, Arthur.
Yes, so I'm preparing for a lot of construction this week. So I got to get off the phone and literally pack up my kitchen so the painters will be able to begin as soon as they arrive.
All right, well, get off the phone and...
I'll talk to you next Monday when the painters do arrive, and I'll tell you if they've arrived.
Okay.
You know, the contractors never show up.
That's right. That's because they're very busy, and they can choose to do this.
Oh, please.
All right.
Take care.
Take care, Arthur. That is Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio. You'll find him on the web here at Arthur Schwartz on our on-demand page, which is robinhoodradio.com. On demand, Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. On the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Groceries on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.